Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, and welcome to another Moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. And again, we're going to power through another podcast. Last week, I had to power through my laryngitis and getting off an airplane to do last week's show. This week, I guess it's still some of the after effects. And been dealing with a cold. Thank God it's only a cold and nothing more serious. So, but it's kind of worked out where I did a blog about the conflict in the Middle East, in Israel and Gaza. And if y'all want to check that out, you know, you can go to Eric Fleming, ericrfleming.info and read that. And that would kind of be a precursor to what I'm going to talk about today. But before I get into all of that, it's time for a moment of news. And again, I just want to say before I turn it over to Grace G, I just really appreciate her and her contribution to the podcast. We've been doing this now for a month, and I think the feedback I've gotten has been very, very positive. And so I wanted that to be out there. And as you know, I'm still trying to get y'all to subscribe, and the more subscribers, the more I can guarantee that this feature and maybe some others can come forward. So y'all go to patreon.com slash a moment with Eric Fleming and subscribe. Like I said, it's only a dollar. If you want to give more, there's options to give more, and you'll get something for that if you do. But please subscribe. Please, you know, support all the other things that are out there on behalf of the podcast. Interact with us on social media and stuff. Just look for A Moment with Eric Fleming, and on most of the stuff, Spoutable, we got an account there. We got an account on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it. Spill. We're trying to be everywhere possible. So that, I think we even have an account on Black Planet. I'm just saying, we're everywhere on social media. And so if you want to interact, you can. People are starting to interact on the website, momenteric.com. And so we're gonna deal with all that too. So yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge Grace's contribution, and we want to keep that going. So now I'm going to turn it over to Grace,
and a moment of news.
Thanks, Eric. About 500 Palestinians were killed in a blast at a Gaza City hospital, with conflicting reports attributing the blast to either an Israeli airstrike or a failed rocket launch by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad militant group. U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to provide $100 million in new funding for humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Gaza and the Israeli-occupied West Bank during his trip to Israel. The U.S. vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for humanitarian pauses in the Israel-Palestine conflict to allow humanitarian aid access to Gaza, citing further negotiations are needed. The U.S. issued sanctions aimed at disrupting funding for Hamas and people and companies in Iran, Hong Kong, China, and Venezuela for supporting Iran's ballistic missile and drone programs. An Illinois man was charged with hate crimes for killing a 6-year-old Muslim boy, Wadea Al-Fayoum, and injuring his mother in response to the conflict between Israel and Hamas. A federal judge has disallowed Donald Trump from verbally attacking U.S. prosecutors, court staff, and potential witnesses in a criminal case accusing him of attempting to overturn his 2020 election loss. Right-wing Republican Jim Jordan failed twice to secure enough votes to become the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. A black man, Leonard Allen Cure, previously exonerated after serving 16 years for an armed robbery conviction, was fatally shot by a Georgia sheriff's deputy during a traffic stop. FBI data shows that violent crimes decreased in the United States in 2022, while property crime increased. And a Federal Reserve survey showed that American families saw significant income and wealth increases between 2019 and 2022, but there were notable disparities among racial and economic groups. I am Grace G, and this has been A Moment of News.
All right, thanks, Grace, for that moment of news. And now, as I'm recording this, there's going to be yet another vote on the speaker's race in the Capitol, and that's going to take place. It's taking place as I'm recording this. Let me get my mind together. And Jim Jordan's going to lose again, right? And that should be the end of that. So by the time this podcast comes out, the effort for Jim Jordan to be speaker should be over and done. And maybe by the time this podcast airs, that there's been some kind of resolution or an attempt to get to a resolution to set up a speaker at least till the end of the year, because they want to have a speaker in place for two things. One, the government is prone to shut down again. The measure that they passed recently extended it out till November 17th, I believe. And so you're going to need a speaker to deal with the legislation coming forward to pass a budget prior to November 17th, right? Or else the government shutdown that almost happened will happen, right? And then we've got this package that the president is presenting to Congress to have funding for support for Israel to defend itself and to basically restock the Iron Dome. That's the main purpose, is to make sure that the munitions that are needed for the Iron Dome to be effective, that they're restocked, right? And other munitions. More, it's also including munitions for Ukraine, money for them and weapons for them to continue their fight against Russia. It's also going to provide money for Taiwan and the whatever we need to assist Taiwan in the inevitable attempt for China to try to retake it, because, you know, China's been laying in the cut watching the development with Ukraine and Russia. And then, of course, now the Israeli conflict, the Gaza conflict has kicked in. And, you know, because if you noticed in that UN resolution that Grace talked about, in the news, China abstained, I think. No, China voted for the ceasefire and Russia abstained. Right. So China's been trying to play this, you know, hey, you know, we're not trying to instigate anything and all this stuff, you know, but they've been sending some signals to Taiwan. It's like, you know, we're coming to get y'all as soon as all this is over with. And they're just trying to see how the United States is playing it in order to decide whether they're going to make their move or not. And it's almost kind of like the way that Japan made a calculated maneuver in 1941, watching to see how the United States, because the United States prior to December 7th was staying out of the European conflict in World War II. Hitler was doing his thing, and Britain had been begging and pleading for the United States and other countries to get more involved outside of the continent, because Germany was whooping everybody else in the continent and they needed some help. And the United States felt that they didn't have the resources, the manpower, or the interest. And there were some political undertones too, because there were people that were empathetic to the Nazis and some influence in Washington at the time. And I can't remember the name of Rachel Maddow's podcast, but find that podcast and it goes into detail about the history about that, right? And we know that there were some prominent people like Charles Lindbergh and Henry Ford that were sympathetic to the Nazis too. And that kind of ties into what we're dealing with now with the anti-Semitism. But anyway, Japan kind of was watching to see how the United States was acting, and they kind of felt, well, if the United States is not going to engage, then this is our time to assert dominance in the Pacific. And the best way to do that was to basically bomb the largest Navy installation and send a message that the Pacific Ocean is our territory now, which basically, in the words of the Emperor, awakened the sleeping giant, which was the United States, and turned us into the war machine that we are now. Right. So China's kind of calculating on that regard. And then finally, the coup de grace in this package is that there's going to be money for increasing the border patrol and security on the border. And that's going to coincide with some money that is kicking in now that Trump had gotten passed to build the wall. Now, Biden had said that he didn't want to do anything with the wall, but since that money had already been approved, that money has to be spent. And so now is the time for that money to be spent. So there will be construction along the wall. So what Biden is trying to do from his administration is to put more money into the Border Patrol, which I don't know if my previous guest, JJ Cantrell, will be appreciative of that. He probably won't. But I think the president is trying to address some concerns that Cantrell brought on the show and in his book, right, that he highlighted on the show. So that's the package. And we know there is a good package because our friend from Mississippi State, who now is the senator, I guess she's the senior senator in Tennessee now, Marsha Blackburn, is upset that Biden has created this amazing omnibus package to address all those concerns. And she was like, so how dare he do that? You know what I'm saying? It's like, that's how it works in politics, Senator. You know, you try to get all the stuff you want done in one package. And I guess she's mad because she wants to support the money for Israel, but she doesn't want to tie it in, and she wants to support the money for the Border Patrol, but she doesn't want to. She may even support the situation in Taiwan. I don't know. But she doesn't want to give money to Ukraine for whatever reason. Excuse me. So she's mad that the Ukraine money is tied into this package, which means she's probably going to vote for it and just be mad at it, or vote against it and have to explain to her constituents why she voted against money for Israel, right? So that's why she's mad, but that's part of the game. That's okay. You know, in politics, when, you know, the roles were reversed and President Bush, you know, or even President Trump, when they were able to put together packages, you know, Democrats had to vote for it because there was stuff in there that they wanted. You know what I'm saying? That's how that works. So she'll get over it because I believe they're going to pass it. But the key thing is they got to get a speaker. And to me, the only way that they're going to do it is either the Republicans have to mature in a record amount of time, which I don't think that's going to happen, in the sense that they decide on either letting the interim speaker, God, now I can't remember the boy's name, who is currently speaking now, Patrick, God, I got to look him up real quick, maintain him as the speaker and give him some duties and powers to carry forth legislation. Patrick McHenry. I should have remembered that. Patrick McHenry. Anyway, to give McHenry the authority to actually be the speaker in the sense of getting legislation through and all that stuff, right? Or some Republicans like Ken Buck and a few others who basically have said that Jim Jordan and his supporters have threatened them. Which, by the way, Jim Jordan is getting worse. Now, I don't know what the vote's going to be today as we're recording, but he's losing support as the votes go. And based on the way that they call the roll, you'll know by the letter F or G whether Jordan has the votes or not, because most of his opposition is coming from the early alphabet. Right. So if he gets more than 7 or 8 people, I think the number is magic number is 5. Maybe he gets more than 5 people to vote against him, then it's over with. And the last vote, by the time they got to the F's and G's, it was he already had 8 votes against him. So, yeah, it's pretty much in the, he went from being 20, losing 20 Republicans to losing 22, and he's probably going to lose more today. So anyway, that's where we are with the speaker's race. And if they don't come up, if Buck and them or any group of Republicans decide, hey, you know, let's get together and with the Democrats and come up with, you know, a temporary solution, which the Democrats may be cool with. Well, I didn't. No, they don't want McHenry in there. Democrats have kind of said McHenry is a non-starter as well. And I think that goes to just some of the stunts that were pulled right after McCarthy was booted out. But they, you know, come up with somebody that they compromise that the Democrats can get behind to make sure that, you know, there's enough votes for that person to get elected and get some of the Republicans. I don't know if you're going to get a coalition of 100 Democrats to support a Republican. I think the ideal situation for the Democrats, what they would like, is to get some of the Republicans to vote with them and put Akeem Jeffries into the speakership already. That would be the ideal situation. And don't know. I mean, there are 17 Republicans that are in districts that Joe Biden won in 2020. And maybe those 17, along with the 212 Democrats, would form a coalition to put Akeem Jeffries into the speakership. And then Jeffries will preside until the next term. And then if the Democrats, as it's looking right now, the Democrats take control of the House again, then Jeffries will be the speaker for another term. And that would be historic, not just for him being the first black and all that stuff, but to become the speaker as a minority party person. I really have to study history, and there's any historians that listen to this, maybe you can tell me when that happened. But I don't think that's ever happened before, where the minority party got to control the House. So I think that would be, that'll definitely be historic in our lifetime, but I don't know if it's historic in the sense that it's never happened before. But I'm willing to bet that it hasn't, right? So, I mean, that's where we are. And that's all because of dysfunction. And that's all because of people being elected who had no intention of governing, but was there to be a disruptive force. Again, when people run for office and say that they're against government, but they're running to serve in the government, don't vote for them, because they're trying to destroy government. Now, if you want government destroyed, okay, then that's your candidate. But the majority of us who vote in these elections want people in government to make government better, right? So from this point forward, it doesn't matter what political party they line up with. If they say that I'm against government as it is, don't vote for them. You know, just say, you know, we want government to exist. because history has shown us that when we put people in like you, government doesn't function, and we kind of need the United States government to function. Not just the citizens of the United States. It's apparent that the citizens of the world need the United States government to function, right? And, you know, so that's just kind of my take on it. I think that, you know, we've got to get people in that are serious. And I want to highlight something to transition into something else. So in the Cannon office building, a number of people, and I think Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib had something to do with this gathering, which is cool. Rashida Tlaib is a Palestinian American who represents a district in Michigan. She's part of the squad. Y'all remember the squad with her and Presley and AOC and, you know, Cori Bush and all that. You know, these were the sisters that, and I think Katie Porter was even in the squad. These were the sisters, you know, on the Democratic side that came in and was pushing this, you know, this real liberal, some would say radical agenda to, you know, deal with issues like climate change and social justice and all this stuff, right? So Rashida has been one of the most outspoken members. I can't forget Oman. Let me put her name out there. One of the most outspoken members, especially when it comes to issues dealing with the relationship between Israel and Palestine. If you remember, she went over to Palestine to visit relatives, and she wanted to come over to Israel and speak with some Palestinians there. I think she had some relatives there that were actually living in Israel. And Netanyahu refused to let her visit in Israel. And he was trying to base it on some stuff she had said, and I don't know, campaign or whatever. But so she's not a big fan of Netanyahu, personally. But, of course, the tragedy in Gaza and Israel has taken a toll on everybody that actually gives a damn about human rights in the world, and especially in the United States. And I would classify her as one of those people. And so there was a gathering that she spoke at the Cannon building of people who were Jewish who were opposing the way that Israel was attacking Gaza. So let me say that again. These were Jewish Americans who were protesting Israel's assault on Gaza. And they gathered at the Cannon office building. And of course, you know, they had signs and they were out cheering and all that stuff. But it was just a demonstration, right? With a lot of people. And so after they got to a certain point, you know, it was time for them to leave. They didn't want to leave. So the Capitol Police escorted them out. And in D.C., it's kind of an obligatory thing. You go to jail, you pay $50, you're out, right? So most groups that plan big demonstrations like that, they budget in bail money. Most of the people left on their own accord, you know, but there were some that were willing to be arrested, and they did. But in D.C., that's just kind of like, you know, $50. And, you know, basically by the time you process, you're out. So, you know, because, I mean, we've had U.S. congressmen do that, and especially, you know, when dealing, I mean, it's been around for a long time, because, you know, John Lewis and You know, a lot of others have been arrested. So, you know, it's not a big deal on that deal. But the reason why I bring this up is because Marjorie Taylor Greene obviously was trying to do some business. I guess her office is in Cannon now. I don't know. But she saw the demonstration and she decided she wanted to record it. And the first thing that came out of her mouth was, "Oh my God, there's an insurrection at the Capitol." Now, of course, that led to a whole chorus of people like her saying, "Oh, well, they got an insurrection. I bet they won't punish them and treat them the way they treated the J6 people and all that stuff." And I'm like, no, they're not, because these people are not, first of all, they're not at the Capitol. They're at the Cannon office building. That's one. Two, they're not tearing up anything. They're not defecating on the floor. They're not breaking into anybody's office. They're literally in one spot in the atrium. They came in peacefully and did their protest, had their speaker speak, and basically just tried to overstay their welcome, but they weren't disrupting the process, right? Because members had been voting while they were having their program. So members were leaving the Capitol, going to speak, and then coming back for whatever business needed to be taken care of, right? So it was not an insurrection. But now that's the spin. It's like, oh, they had this insurrection and da da da. And so that's the danger of these people, these disruptors, is that they want to create disruption in any way, shape, or form, especially with language. And, you know, their whole agenda is to twist things around so that people will have this view that, oh, well, you know, we're being persecuted for what we did, but they're not being persecuted for what they did. This ultimate projection, denial, hypocrisy, whatever you want to look at it as. And we can't get caught up in that, right? Our bigger focus is trying to support a peaceful resolution to what's going on over there. And so I wanted to use that to tie in, and of course I'm probably going to have to finish it on the other side, but to tie in one mistake I think Joe Biden did, and maybe it was a mistake that had to be made. I don't even know if it was even thought out, but it's something that I probably would have entertained if I was in that position. And I understand that Congress is in session and all that, but I think if you know, the general perception of the United States and most world powers, to be honest, except Russia and China, is that, you know, everybody's pro-Israel, right? And so the concept of pro-Israel is the same that, at least to me, and, you know, y'all can correct me, the concept of pro-Israel to me, as far as the United States goes and other world powers or world leaders, is the same as being pro-Ukraine, is that this is a nation state and they have the right to exist. Bottom line. And so the concept of respecting countries that have formed and exist through the will of the people should be recognized. And any government that, whether it's internal, like military coups or whatever, or external, like other nations trying to take them over, is frowned upon, right? So I think that's the general stance. But what kind of clouds the issue is the way that Israel has always responded to the threats. And it's no different than Turkey, and the people used to say, "Oh my God, the Turks are involved. It's gonna get bloody," right? But that's the way they feel about Israel when it gets to conflicts. And with people like Netanyahu and all that, they didn't disappoint. They were very, very brutal, right? Instead of doing like the United States did and tried to pinpoint particular targets, they just started bombing the hell out of Gaza. Literally, like, just blowing the hell out of it. So now that we're at the point where the president has pledged $100 million for aid, and now other countries are kicking in, which was kind of the reason why the U.S. didn't support the ceasefire resolution, is because the main focus they were trying to do right now is to get the aid in to the people and then maybe re-entertain the ceasefire at that point. But right now, asking for the ceasefire is one thing, but it's not going to be enforced, because Hamas is positioning themselves for an invasion from the Israeli defensive forces on the ground into Gaza. And, now you could convince Israel to continue to hold off, which is what Biden was trying to do. He was buying some time. And I believe privately he was telling Netanyahu, look, pinpoint your attacks. Don't just bomb the hell out of everybody, because now you've created a human rights violation. You created a human rights crisis in Gaza by just bombing everything and putting concrete into the water and the infrastructure. So, and I'm going to speed this up, but it's like, so I think that conversation happened while they were meeting. But I think the mistake was that Rashida Tlaib should have been part of his delegation to go over there. And I think that would have sent a message to the world that the United States is really serious about Israel being able to defend itself against Hamas, right? But on the flip side, we do not want to see Palestinians, innocent Palestinians, wiped out because of what Hamas did. And Rashida Tlaib could have been that person, especially in the conversation with Mahmoud Abbas and the leaders from Jordan and Egypt, to kind of, even if they didn't want to have the physical meeting, at least have the communication. But from what I understand, Tlaib has been reaching out to the White House for certain things, and they've kind of pushed her back for whatever reason, at least from her office. That's what they're saying, that she's kind of asked for some stuff and they haven't responded. And I think if there's any congressional person or any, that's really in a position that should be highlighted and should be lifted up, it's her. I don't know her from Adam's house cat as far as personally, but for what I've seen and basically, her background, her agenda, her politics, maybe she should have been part of the group to go over there. You know, I mean, and they could have, I mean, if he wanted to balance it out, he could have had Jamie Raskin and her go, right? And they get along, by the way. And so, you know, just show, hey, look, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, and then we expect y'all to do the same thing. You know, we do not want Hamas to gain a foothold anywhere on the planet, let alone here. But at the same time, we can't endorse attacking innocent people. And, you know, there have been some that have been trying to cover it up on the right, saying, and they're not necessarily agreeing with Biden, because they just can't agree with Biden by their creed, but they have been trying to say, well, you know, they voted for Hamas. So let me drop this on you before we go to the other side. Hamas got elected, I think, to rule Gaza. And I pointed some of this out in the blog. Hamas got elected to represent Gaza, and I want to say it was while I was still in the state legislature in Mississippi. It was early 2000s. And after they got in, they did what we're afraid that Donald Trump would do if he gets back in, and they basically stopped free elections. So the people in Gaza have been stuck with Hamas as quote-unquote political leadership since the early 2000s. So it's almost been 20 years that they've had to deal with these people. And they've had no say-so in that. Now, you know, I assume that Hamas has been providing services and all this kind of stuff for the people to exist, but as long as Hamas was in control, then Israel wasn't allowing Gaza to have free commerce or free travel in and out. Now, if you lived on the West Bank under the rule of what used to be the PLO, I think they call it the Palestinian Authority now, they've had access. So citizens in the West Bank have been able to have commerce and all that stuff. But people in Gaza have been stuck. And that's basically because of the rift between the Palestinian Authority, or Fatah, and Hamas. And, you know, Fatah tried to control both, and Hamas beat them in a military conflict. So, you know, Hamas is just basically kind of taken over. And so, you know, this is, you know, the conditions that the people on the Gaza Strip have been in have not been of their own free will. So they've been victimized by Israel and Hamas, really, for almost 20 years. And now they're getting bombed, and they don't know where to go. And so I think somebody like Congresswoman Tlaib coming over there and having relationships with people there, and, you know, understanding the dynamics, she could have been a person to kind of really articulate to Netanyahu and even to the president what really needs to be done. Is $100 million enough, right? That kind of thing. I think it would have helped if she had gone over, is what I'm saying. But she's doing her job as a member of Congress, and she's going to continue to be a voice here in the United States to remind us that you know, that we have the capacity to support Israel against a terrorist attack, but at the same time, defend the human rights of the people of the Gaza Strip, the Palestinians there. And there's some Palestinian Americans that are living there as well, people that have dual citizenship. So I just wanted to get that thought out, and we'll catch y'all on the other side. All right, and so we are back. So I wanted to get all those thoughts out about the speaker and the Middle East thing out of the way, because I wanted to talk about something, and I don't know, you know, I can talk, as people of the podcast have acknowledged. And I don't know how long it's going to take for me to complete this thought in this second half, but something came to my attention. I listen to a lot of podcasts, you know, and first I want to acknowledge something that I heard. That I think there is a podcast that, you know, that I love called Woke AF, and Daniel Moody is the host of that podcast. It's one of my favorites, and Danielle has been a voice of anger. And I laugh when I say that, because Danielle is very articulate and very intelligent, but she has been raging against the machine known as racism and white supremacy basically ever since she started the show, and has propelled her to be one of the top podcasters in the country. And so I listened to her show, and I encourage others that listen to this podcast, listen to hers as well. But there's another podcast called Make It Plain, and it's this brother named Mark Henderson, and Mark is a preacher. If that name sounds familiar, when the two Justins were going through their BS in Tennessee, Mark was kind of their spiritual advisor. He was seen with them at the Capitol. He was, you know, walking with them and speaking on their behalf on national shows. Well, Mark's had this podcast, and one of the highlights of his podcast is that every 4th of July, he recites the 4th of July speech that Frederick Douglass gave, right? Which is powerful if you read it, but to hear somebody say it, especially somebody that has been trained to be a speaker, as a preacher he is. It's really, really profound. The only bad thing about it is he's got to have commercial breaks in there. So it kind of cuts the continuity. But if you could hear it ad-free straight through, it's tremendous. So Mark was on Danielle's show. And I want y'all to listen to it. It's called Burning the Sheets. If you don't listen to any other podcast outside of mine, listen to that particular episode. I want you to go Woke AF, and the episode is called Burning the Sheets. And I'm going to leave it at that, because when you hear that, that's going to give you some clarity, you know, even more so than me and any other podcasters that have been out there you know, trying to tie all this in together. But the analogy that Mark makes on Danielle's show should hit home for you. So I want y'all to listen to that. Having said that, one of the people who has been respected in the Black community for a long time as an intellectual is running for president of the United States, Cornel West. And maybe in another time, you know, say prior to Obama being elected, it would have been very, very practical for us to consider his candidacy, right? Like we considered Al Sharpton, serious. Like we considered Jesse Jackson, serious. And even in a time like 2016, maybe it would have been considered an option because the focus would have been on the issues that Cornell would bring out. And even though Donald Trump was emerging to be on the ballot, a Cornel West candidacy in 2016 would have made sure that the Black agenda was going to be forefront in that campaign. So when Donald Trump would say some things, Cornel West could attack it. And then if Hillary Clinton wanted to get the Black vote, she would either embrace it or build on it, right? I think she would have campaigned harder in the Black community, and especially in particular places in the Black community, if, you know, and campaigned harder in some traditional white bases that she needed to secure, like maybe in union states, to have more of an effective campaign. I think it would have weeded out or nullified a Jill Stein, who I still don't know her motivation, right? I would love to have somebody like her or somebody from the Green Party on the show. And I'm going to just tell y'all straight up, I'm going to try to invite somebody from the Green Party if I can. I'm going to try to get somebody from No Labels. I have a number of people in my network that's affiliated with No Labels that I'm going to reach out to, see if I can get one of them on. You know, I may try to get Larry back on, Larry Sharp, if schedule permits. I mean, we got time until November, but, you know, just trying to line stuff, November next year, I should say. You know, trying to line up all of these issues, right? Because there are a lot of things that are out there, and a lot of people are saying this really, if Trump's the nominee, then Biden should be the Democratic nominee, and that should be it. Nobody else should be in the fray. But that's not how this country works. Now, we're not like other nations that have democracies where there's multiple political parties that can elect people to parliament or to their equivalent of U.S. Congress, right? We've basically been a two-party system, and we've tried to confine the political arguments between those two parties. And however independent or third-party candidates have influenced issues in the election, which is great because we get to discuss them and hold the two major parties accountable to address those things. You know, for example, let's just say, you know, as much as people criticize Ralph Nader, right, for pulling enough votes where George Bush had a chance to win the election over Al Gore, it changed the course of political history. One, George Bush got elected by the Supreme Court. And Al Gore basically pushed Ralph Nader off the environmental stage because Ralph Nader was kind of the leading environmental voice at that time. And now Al Gore has won a Nobel Peace Prize for climate change and his work toward that, which, you know, if people looked at it the way I do, it's kind of like the ultimate revenge. It's like, yeah, you beat me, you helped contribute me not be president, but I took away your platform. I mean, that's reality. And people don't want to say it like that, but that's true. You know? So, you know, in essence, what I'm saying is that third parties play a role in the dynamic, even though they realistically don't have a shot to win. And then some of those candidates, you know, instead of lining up with a third party, decide to run either in the Republican or Democratic primaries to kind of push their agenda. And then, you know, they'll drop out and maybe file to run as independent in the general election or whatever. But, you know, but Jill Stein, I don't know. Because I've known Green Party people. One of my dear friends and supporters in Mississippi was adamant Green Party person. And, you know, she was initially a Democrat, and she just got tired of what she thought the Democrats weren't doing, and she just committed to being a Green Party person. But, you know, and the Green Party has been more than just environmental. They've been social justice as well. But I've never really heard Jill Stein talk about those issues. Now, I've just heard she was running, right? And I guess I got to research, you know, like YouTube and all that stuff to really find speeches that she gives. But the thing that threw the cloud over me with her was her meeting with Putin in Moscow. Whatever, that just was not a good look for me. And she probably can explain it, and, you know, it'd probably be acceptable to most people outside of the Green Party. If she, you know, but she's never really publicly talked about that, defended it or said it was a mistake or anything. Just, it is what it is, which leads me to believe that what's your agenda, right? Because if you run for a political office, you have an agenda, you have, you know, because an agenda is different from a platform. A platform are the issues that you run on. Like, it's like, I'm for this, I'm against that, right? But an agenda is your philosophy of when you go in to elective office, what are you going to do? How are you going to go about doing it, right? Because, like I said, the Republicans didn't have a platform in 2020, but they had an agenda. And their agenda was to set up authoritarian rule, because they're looking at the numbers and they feel that the political process as it's set up now doesn't favor them. Okay. So I've done all this setup to get back to who I'm talking about. So Cornel West is the guy that I'm talking about. As far as like him running. And a disturbing story came across the news that Harlan Crow, the guy who has been the benefactor for Clarence Thomas, and benefactor is a kind word. In legal terms, it may be extortionist or whatever. But you got to prove that Clarence voted a certain way on Supreme Court cases to benefit Crow. So we'll leave it at benefactor. So for this guy to give $3,300 to Cornel West is intriguing to me, right? Now, Cornel was initially going to run as a People's Party candidate. And I think when Sister Figaro was highlighting his candidacy, and she devoted a number of episodes on her podcast, Tyson Figaro. God, now I can't remember that. Look up Tyson Figaro and you'll see her podcast. And she's been doing the podcast for a while. She's tied in with the Breakfast Club and all that stuff. And, you know, she was basically using her platform to justify why Cornel West should be considered a candidate for president. And I've made my arguments why he shouldn't, right? Strictly on issues, not personalities or anything else. But now this thing has come up. So anyway, when Tyson and all those folks, he was tied in with the People's Party. Well, he decided not to do the People's Party thing. And then he was going to align with Jill Stein and the Green Party. And actually, it was going to kind of be, I think Cornell was the presidential candidate and Jill was going to be the vice presidential nominee. And they actually have a convention and all this stuff. And I think the convention is going to be in Denver this year. I may be wrong, but I think that's where I read that there's going to be in Denver. And so they were in the process of putting all that together. Because I think the People's Party thing lasted maybe about a couple of weeks. And then the Green Party thing lasted for maybe a couple of months. And now he's not running as a Green Party candidate. He's just running as an independent. Kind of like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. But then this news about Harlan Crow writing this man a check came up. Now, Harlan Crow has given money to Chris Christie, right? And Chris Christie's PACs. So he's kind of hedging his bets, I guess, but he's not contributing to people that right now the polls show don't have a chance to win. But Christie has been the anti-Trump Republican, at least the loudest voice, and the one that's been able to get on the debate stage. And, you know, and then Cornel West has basically been pro-black, right? he's the black intellectual. He's the person who wants to fight racism with love, which, you know, is basically the strategy of Dr. King and others in the nonviolent movement have practiced, right? So, you know, this guy has been a benefactor to Clarence Thomas, but he gives money to Chris Christie, and now he's giving money to Cornel West. Now, Dr. West has said that him and Crow have had a relationship. They've been friends. And so it wasn't a surprise to him that Crow reached out and gave him a contribution. And I get that. From a personal side, I've had people who, you know, because of our relationship, they gave me money, even though they weren't necessarily supporting me or didn't think that I was going to win against a particular candidate. But because of our relationship and our respect for each other, I got a contribution. So I get that in a sense. But I'm trying to figure out, I can get the relationship between Harlan Crow and Clarence Thomas. I can get that relationship because Clarence Thomas has transformed his hate of, I don't want to say himself, because I think he loves himself, right? I think his ego proves that. His hubris proves that. But the fact that he was in, he's in black skin, and he's felt that he's had to battle the black skin in his own way, right? You know, if you understand his background, you understand how people teased him because he was dark skinned, and these were black kids, right, in Georgia. And then, of course, you know, his credentials being questioned because he was a black guy who got into Harvard and or Yale into, you know, through affirmative action or whatever. And he's always, and he's battled that. And so he's turned that into hate. And that's why he goes against those kind of programs. And he became this conservative voice. Right. And if you study a lot of the black conservatives, you'll see a similar kind of pattern. And I'm not saying anything negative about that per se. But again, it's the argument of history. If you understand a person's background, if you understand what they've been through and their experiences, you understand why it shapes their politics. Whether you agree with their politics or not. So, Harlan Crow has more in common with Clarence Thomas politically. You know, as far as being pro-business and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Crow is a billionaire, right? And then Chris Christie, I get that. Because Christie, you know, was a pro-business governor. He's a Republican. He ran on his record of being a tough U.S. attorney. And, you know, so, you know, I get that. And maybe Harlan Crow doesn't like Donald Trump, which, you know, a lot of people don't. Right? But the Cornel West thing, it bothers me. And so what bothers me is I'm kind of intrigued about Crow's interest in Cornel West. I don't know if Crow looks at West as a disruptor. And, you know, what his grand scheme, because there's a lot of people that have these grand schemes, especially if they've got money to kind of influence things. They have these grand schemes of how to orchestrate stuff. Like they're like movie producers in their head, and they want to create these particular outcomes. But, you know, I don't know. It may be dangerous to kind of try to get into Harlan Crow's mind. But I do want to say this to Cornel West. Right? And I want him to understand this as somebody that I respect. You are now officially a politician. When you took that money from Harlan Crow, whether it's because you're friends or not, and you doubled down and defended accepting the money, you are now a politician. You can't run and say, well, I'm not, you know, this typical guy, and, you know, I'm not this DC dude, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. You are. Because when you start accepting money from those kind of people, right? I get it. You didn't get it from a PAC. You didn't get it from a political party. You got it from an individual. But the way that individual operates, right? And the signal that you sent by saying you had no problem accepting the money from him. Well, now there are other people who may think like Crow or may not think like Crow, but may look at you in a different way than maybe you look at yourself in your political campaign. And now they're going to give money to you. Right? Or at least they're entertaining the thought. If they feel that you're going to peel off X amount of the black vote to help Trump or whoever the Republican nominee is, right, in 2024, they may give you some money, right? But when you basically did what you did, you said you were open for business. And somebody running for president of the United States, you know, when you say you're open for business, you'll take money from a Harlan Crow or anybody, you know, except for a PAC, of course, right? But you're taking money from individuals, but you're a politician. And you can't retract from that at this point. Now, you know, once the campaign's over and you go back to, you know, teaching and writing books and giving lectures and all that stuff, cool. You know, but as far as this campaign goes, you've officially crossed that line. You're not a you may have a grassroots background. And you may articulate some issues, but you're a politician. And you can't say that you're just an average Joe who just wants to have a voice. No, no. You're a politician. And if you are going to run for president, and if you're going to take those kind of contributions, and if you're serious about it, then you're going to have to make a decision, right? How you're going to run your campaign, who this is. Now, I understand you pulled a guy from the Green Party to be your campaign manager. But from this point forward, you have to run as a campaign. When you give speeches, you have to tell people to vote for you. Right? You have to have an agenda. Well, at least a platform. I would like to know what your agenda really is, but at least to have a platform, right? And you're going to have to avail yourself to questions about what would you do if you were the president right now with this situation in Gaza and Israel? What would you do if Russia and Ukraine is still going on when you assume the position? What would you do if China decided to invade Taiwan? What would you do if in Burkina Faso, the military occupation, which supposedly now is supposed to be a democracy because they're supposed to have elections, if those elections fail, and the military or the it doesn't go the way the military wanted it to go, what would you do? right? What are you going to do about the immigration issue? What are you going to do about inflation? It's time for you to get real. If you're going to take money from Harlan Crow and other billionaires like that, don't come at me about love, peace, brother, you know, whatever. No, we ain't got time for that. You have decided to open your shingle for business. So I need to hear something substantive from you. Now, you may say, well, Eric, I could care less. That's fine. But I'm not the only one that's going to demand that from you. See, Joe Biden has the power of the incumbency. He's the president. Donald Trump has the power of a political party that's in shambles. But he's a leader of a party. And he was the president. So he has some incumbency on him. Whether you agree with his track record, he has one. Whether you agree with Biden's track record, he has one. You have to step up your game. Because if no labels gets in the picture, they're going to pick somebody that has a track record, like a Joe Manchin or somebody like that. Right? If you're going to take that kind of money, you have put yourself in the game, in the big leagues. And this can't be no feel-good crusade anymore. This is what you're going to do for black folks specifically, right? Because that was one of the things that you were kind of known for when Obama was there and you were saying, well, this needs to be done for black folks. And Obama didn't really address that and say, so what are you going to do? How are you going to systematically make those changes? How are you going to fulfill the obligation I think every black politician should fulfill? And that is to create black wealth. What is your specific plan for that? But as long as you are just kind of bouncing around and using this to kind of build your national profile or whatever, that's lovely and great. But, you know, those kind of people don't get checks from billionaires either. Especially billionaires who've been in the news for giving checks to Supreme Court justices and other presidential candidates. Is it something that you said to him that kind of makes him think that you're pro-business with all this other radical stuff that you talk about, or what? So now it's time for Cornel West to be accountable. And not accountable in the sense that who else is giving the money, but accountable as, how serious are you for running? And why should we seriously take our time to consider your candidacy? Because you raised the stakes by accepting that check. And if you're not ready to step up and do that, maybe you should give the money back. All right, guys, I'm going to end it on that. There's some other stuff I'm going to talk about, and I'll probably put that on my Patreon. So if you want to listen, I shouldn't say probably. There's some other stuff I want to address. So if you want to hear what else I got to say, go to patreon.com. A Moment with Eric Fleming. Until next time.